and welcome to another exciting episode here at IT Pro TV. I'm your host, Mike Roderick. Today we're doing our CISSP, and specifically we're going to be getting into site and facility design, and to that end, physical security. You know, it's one of those areas that I think most of us have a good understanding of some basic physical security, but there's really some areas that sometimes I find it are kind of surprising that we don't think about or get left off of the list or not checked. So here to help us with that is Mr. Adam Gordon. How you doing, Adam?
I'm good. I'm also anchored to the floor so nobody can walk away with me. I'm physically secure.
Perfect.
Very important, right? Because I'm wearing my extra special socks this morning and you don't want anybody to steal those.
I don't know if we've even seen that.
I don't think we did.
We should go back out to the wide shot.
You got to get rid of my name there to see them. So I have the gray with the orange polka dots on this morning. I'm rocking an orange polka dot gray pair of socks, in case anybody was wondering. All right. So when we think about physical security, right? Well, we're thinking about ultimately site design, physical security, facility security. We're thinking about the things that we have to do in order to make the operational environments that we are going to live in, work in every day, more secure, right? The goal is not to let bad actors get to our stuff. If they come and they can find our stuff, they're probably going to take it away, or we're going to have to fight with them to make sure they can't. We'd rather keep them far away and let them go bother somebody else, right? We often talk, and I have often talked about this idea of, you know, being this much better than the attacker that's coming to take your stuff. If you can do that, they're going to hopefully go down the street somewhere, right, logically or physically, and they're going to go play in somebody else's backyard. And if that person isn't that much better, then they're going to take their stuff. That sucks for them, but it doesn't suck for you. And so what you want to make sure is that you don't let people get near your stuff, right? This is a really important thought process. So we got to start figuring out how to do that by first understanding where our stuff is, right? And what is the boundary of what is ours? So we have to do a survey. Specifically, we do what's called a site survey. And a security site survey is really what we're focused on. What are the outlying boundaries? What are the areas we have to defend? What do they look like? What stuff is where? This is the goal of doing a security survey. We have to understand and assess all the security measures we already have in place and figure out which ones are good and which ones may not be so good. And the ones that are not so good, we have to mark and then ultimately maybe change. So we may have locks on doors, for instance, as an example, but those locks may be easily broken, right? They may not be very sturdy. They may not be locks that are going to actually have a deadbolt that goes into the frame, but rather just one of those little, you know, they push the button in lock on the handle, and the handle's kind of, you know, old and rickety. You could just grab it real hard and turn it, and, you know, the door opens. That kind of a system is not very secure. But a deadbolt that goes into a frame, that frame is cross-set into the door frame itself. It's cross-set into the wall with metal anchors, right? And it's a metal frame, not a wood frame, so it's harder to actually move. And that kind of a system is going to be a lot more secure, right? So we want to look at every possibility. Do we have windows on the ground floor of our building? Most of us probably do. Do we put our data center right up against an area where there are windows that face the outside? If we do that, that's probably not such a good idea because somebody may be able to break in, may be able to throw a rock through the window or, you know, who knows what, but get in. If we have offices that look out, in other words, that's one thing, but even then, ground floor windows are usually not a good idea in secure buildings because they give people a potential avenue to attack us. So we may see windows on upper levels, but it's a lot harder to get to them traditionally. Do we have doors? We probably do, as we said. Do the doors that lead to the outside of the building in remote areas, do they have handles on the outside? Do they have a way of being opened from the outside? Or are they going to be effectively just one-way doors, doors that open out and can be opened from the inside with a crash bar or something, but have no handles, no way at all to open the door from the outside, except maybe a card key swipe of some kind or some sort of a pad that lets you put a code in to open the door. That's going to be a much more secure solution because those kinds of entrances are going to be a lot tougher for somebody to break into. There's nothing to grab onto. There's nothing to pick. There's nothing to pull or pry open. The door is flush against the building, and there's no way to get into it, right? So that's going to be something to consider. Do we have closed-circuit TV systems monitoring the entryways, right? So cameras above the doors. Do we have flood lighting that lights the door area so that they are obviously going to be something that people pay attention to when they walk around the building, drive around at night, whatever. You have this island of bright light around a stair, you know, with a door next to it. People are going to pay attention to that and see that, and they're going to know that if they're standing there, somebody's going to see them. So this is, again, the kind of thing we want to think about. Do we trim all of the landscaping around buildings to move it back and prevent areas that can overgrow so that places, you know, that people may be able to hide are going to be obvious, right? That kind of thing. Do we have parking garages? A lot of us have parking garages attached to our buildings. Do we have good lighting in the garage, or do we have a dark, scary area where people may be able to, again, hide and potentially pop out and, you know, attack somebody? This is the kind of thing we have to think about. It's all this stuff. Where do we put the building? Is the building sited in such a way that we have good sight lines so that people coming up to the building are going to be observed? Or is the building set up in such a way that you can't see people until they show up at your front door? That's a bad thing, because you don't know who's coming and what they're coming with until they're standing in front of you. So in secure buildings, you often see them set back from the road. You will see there's really nothing around them traditionally. They may even be raised higher than the road, so you have to drive up to them. Again, allowing us to observe you, but not just drive up on a straight road. There's usually a winding road that forces you to slow down and go very slowly, because we don't want you gathering a great rate of speed to then be able to crash through a gate or whatever may be there for you to then be able to gain entry. So when you approach a secure base, like a military base, you often see that there are crash barriers and you have to zigzag your way in. And then there's a guard, there's typically a gate system, and there's a bunch of different solutions in place that overlap each other to prevent access easily. Unless you drive up very slowly and they let you in, it's going to be almost impossible for you to crash through that gate and get on the base, right? Unless you're, you know, coming with a huge truck and, you know, all sorts of stuff, and they're going to see that coming, right? So this is the kind of thing that we think about. Defining threats are going to be very important to us, and understanding what kind of threats we may have and what a threat is, and therefore taking steps to prevent them, is really what this conversation is all about. What are the targets that we want to protect, and what are the threats we want to defend against? This is the conversation that ultimately a security professional needs to be thinking about. We think about facility considerations. I, you know, rattled off a whole bunch of them to you just now. We have to think about all the things I mentioned, but also the people that work in the building. You know, are we screening them? For instance, the cleaning crew that's there at night often. Do we really know who they are? I mean, they're often there walking around in the evenings. If anybody's around, there's probably almost nobody in the building at that point in time, especially if they come late at night. You know, I drive by, you know, often a lot of times I'll be working late in my office. When I'm leaving, I'll drive by the office buildings around, depending on which office I'm in. And there are banks, for instance, there are big office towers. And you often see the banks, you know, 11, 12 o'clock at night, 10 o'clock at night, lights are on, and there's people walking around in there. And I'm not talking about, you know, the bankers themselves, and certainly, hopefully not talking about people that are there to borrow money without permission. But typically it's the cleaning crew, right? You'll see them in there late at night if you happen to drive by. And banks leave the windows open on purpose, right? And leave lights on purpose. They want people on the outside to be able to see what's going on the inside. So if there's a robbery, somebody's going to be observed. And when the police show up, they can see who's inside, right? So this is the same reason the car dealers leave lights on all over their lots, right? Because they want people to be obviously aware of the fact that they're watching, they have security there, but also if it's brightly lit, it's going to be a lot tougher for you to steal a car. So it's going to be easier for us to see you. So, you know, these are all things people consider, but who's walking around in their cleaning? I mean, you know, obviously whoever's there is representing a cleaning service. Cleaning service may be the building's own, maybe the bank's own. They may have hired their own people, but it may be a contracted service that the building maintenance people have brought in, and the bank may not actually know who's there. They may have no knowledge of them. All they know is that, you know, they show up in the morning, their garbage is gone. But are the people there really trusted? Have they been cleared? You know, this is a big question for us. Not maybe so much in a bank, because you're not going to be able to walk in and steal money from a bank just because you're there cleaning. It's very hard to do that. Money's locked up. But what about in an office building where stuff may be left out on the desks and we may not really have a policy that says we should walk around at night and clear everybody's desks and lock everything up that's secure? What about if we're throwing away confidential information instead of securely disposing of it, maybe shredding it, things like that? That stuff laying around at night with nobody there and a cleaning crew that's there could easily fall prey to somebody taking it. As a matter of fact, somebody may have purposely inserted themselves into the cleaning crew specifically to go in there and get that information. How tough would it be, if you think about it, to get a job like that, right? I mean, it wouldn't be that difficult to go and apply for a job and to then get yourself inserted into this kind of a system and ultimately go in and have effectively run of the office late at night with nobody there. There may be cameras, there may be things, but the reality is we expect to see cleaning people rubbing down desks and grabbing papers and throwing them in garbage bins and taking garbage out. That's what we expect them to do. So we wouldn't necessarily see that as suspicious behavior. If the guy sat down or the girl sat down at the computer and spent 30 minutes doing this and typing stuff in, we may find that to be a little odd, because cleaning crew people typically are not using computers late at night. They're rubbing them down quickly to clean them, but then they're moving on. But if they're smart about what they do, we might not even see them as being a threat at all. We may not even know that they're there. We may not take notice of them. And this is the idea, right? This is the thing that from a facility standpoint, we have to think about. It's the obvious things that go on in front of our nose every day, the hide in plain sight solutions that we have to consider, because these are the things that often come back to haunt us, right? It's the obvious stuff like a door being propped open to an area that's normally secured because of an air conditioning problem, because of the fact that somebody's running an errand and they forgot their keys, so they prop the door open and they're coming right back. They ran out to their car. Well, you know, that's okay. But the reality is that's a breach of security protocol. You're violating the policy. I mean, there may be a reason for it, but the reality is whatever reason you have is not compelling enough that you should violate the policy. You should follow the rules. That's what should be what ultimately should be compelling. And so when we see this kind of activity, we have to put a stop to it as CISSPs, as security professionals. Somebody props open a door. You know, what you should do as a CISSP is stand by that door, wait for them to come back, ask them what they were thinking, make sure they're aware of the policy, and then make sure that doesn't happen again by reinforcing the positive aspects of what needs to happen on that policy, right? We shouldn't just allow that behavior to go unchallenged, in other words, is what I'm suggesting to you, because if we do, then we turn a blind eye to the obvious security threats that are facing the business. And this is something we have to consider. So there's all sorts of different things we have to think about with a facility consideration in mind. We should also, and we've talked a lot about the idea that we should be doing vulnerability assessments. We should be thinking about them. They should be done both for the software, the hardware, the infrastructure on the computer side, but also for the physical plant, for the building. You know, I joked around with you one of the prior episodes. We talked about the Mission Impossible conversation with data in the vault and, you know, how you get in there and steal it and all the stuff they did right and wrong, you know, when they set that up in the movie. The fact that they had HVAC vents that were big enough that humans could actually crawl through them is a problem, right? You don't need vents that big. You don't. So the reality is when you look at most air conditioning systems, the vents are not big enough to support a human being in there, right? And obviously also the fact that a human will weigh 150 pounds on average or whatever it is, those vents are typically not strong enough to support a human. You go in there, you'll fall right through, right? So the reality is we probably don't often think about that as being an attack vector. But what about a building that may have been engineered differently? What about a building that has reinforced vents that are strapped to the wall or to the ceiling or whatever, and that are big enough because of airflow concerns, volume of air moving through the system, that maybe in theory there is a way for somebody to get in there? We'd have to think about that. We'd have to know about that. We'd have to know enough to look at the plans and understand whether that is an issue or not. And then we'd also have to go double check that what the plans show us is accurate. This is what we would be doing with a vulnerability assessment. What about air intakes? What about where air is sucked into the building through the air conditioning system? If those air intakes are on the ground level and are not protected, somebody could potentially get to them and insert some sort of a substance into the air system, a gas, a foreign substance, whatever it is. It may not be because they want to poison people. It may just be a smoke grenade because they want to clear the building, making people think it's on fire so they can get in. That's the James Bond, right, activity, right? We love that, where he throws the smoke grenade in there, everybody leaves the building, goes right in, steals the Lecter machine. That's from The Spy Who Loved Me, right? Oh, no, that's from Russia with... No, that was The Spy Who Loved Me,
right? I
think so. Yeah. No, from Russia with Love. That was from Russia with Love. So you get a bonus star, by the way, if you can figure out exactly which movie that was. I do think it was from Russia with Love, actually. It was the one that was set in Turkey, right? Okay. Back with Sean Connery years ago. So anyway, he does that. He sets off a smoke grenade and ultimately is then able to go in and actually just steal the code machine, right? Pretty straightforward. But he does that in such a way that nobody knew was going to happen, right? He's able to effectively walk in and, you know, just take what he needs. So something as simple as that, protecting the air intakes, is actually really important as well. In secure buildings, these air intakes are usually up on the roof, and they are protected so that you can't get to them. What about your power generators, right? Your secondary power sources. They're obviously typically going to be outside the building because they're big, they're loud, they're noisy, they belch smoke, all that kind of stuff. They have flammable liquids in them, so you have to store them away from the building because of fire codes. They have to be protected. If you don't have a gate around this thing with closed circuit monitoring so that somebody can't get in there and mess around with it, you're going to have a problem, because if somebody goes in and messes with the power in such a way that they effectively render the generator inoperable, and then they fail over the building on purpose to knock it offline, all your protection systems are running on power, right? Your closed circuit TVs, all the monitoring, all that stuff, the power locks on the doors, the card swipes, et cetera, that's all powered. Even if you have backup generators and you have backup batteries for certain systems, reality is we knock the generators offline, all you have is battery power. And battery power lasts maybe 15, 20 minutes at most. If we can't restore the power before then the building systems are probably going to go dark. we then may be able to get into the building a lot easier because now all the monitoring is effectively not going on. So, you know, these, again, are the kind of things we'd look at. And from a vulnerability assessment standpoint, we'd want to understand what is possible and therefore what we have to defend against. So site planning becomes very important. We have to think about that. We have to think about the roadway design, as I mentioned. Is the road straight? Does it wind? Is it a multi-lane road? Is it a single road? Can we put a choke point there? Can we put a guard with a gate there? Or do we have to worry about the fact that it's a public access road? You know, it's a four-lane highway, and we can't control traffic. So now we have to offer a setback to the building with fencing to effectively create a perimeter, you know, 200, 300, 400 yards out from the front end of the building. These are things we have to consider. If you don't own the building, you may not be able to do those things. If you rent space in a building, it's up to the building management to decide how they're going to secure the physical plant, the physical building. It's not directly in your control. You may be able to control the area on the floor you're in. You may be able to lock out the elevator and say only our people get on. We have a card key. We want exclusive access to our floor. You may be able to do that. But that's really about the extent of what you can do, because people getting into the building on the ground floor, you have no control over. They may provide a guard, they may provide cameras, you know, but there's a limit to what you're going to be able to negotiate that they're going to do for you. But if you own the building, it's a whole different story, right? So we refer to this generically, this idea, as what's known as crime prevention through environmental design, CPTED or CPTED. It's just an acronym that represents the thought process that if we are manipulating our environment to our advantage as defenders, we are a lot more likely to be successful at causing mitigation strategies to come into play and ultimately to be successful preventing attacks. So just think about this. You know, we have to think about the windows, as I said. We have to think about the doors. We have to think about the fences. Is the fence high enough? Are the windows strong enough? Are the windows inaccessible? Are the doors strong enough, right? We have different kinds of glass that we put into windows. We don't just have normal glass. I mean, we could, but obviously normal glass meets rock, right? Rock, paper, glass instead of rock, paper, scissors. Rock, paper, glass, rock, right, meets glass, and then, you know, glass shatters. But if you have impact-resistant glass, we call it hurricane glass in the southeast because we put it into buildings that suffer from these kind of storms. If you have impact-resistant glass, that glass may be rated at up to 150-mile impact or whatever it is. That glass will prevent somebody from, you know, hitting it with a crowbar or whatever. It'll, you know, it'll spiderweb. It may actually crack, but it's not going to give way. So this is the kind of thing we have to think about. You have this kind of glass in automobiles, in your windshields. It's called tempered glass or safety glass. It's not as strong, obviously. But what it does, there's a film between the layers of glass. Think of it as like a sticky, tapey film that sits between the layers of glass and the windshield. When the windshield gets hit with something like a rock or whatever it is, you get in a crash. Again, the windshield spider webs, but it won't just shatter and blow inward on you typically, because it's going to effectively stick together. And as a result, it's safer for you being in the cab. That's why you often see in those movies where they have to kick out the windshield. The guy's kicking it, it's not going anywhere, and they got to knock the whole frame out of the windshield to actually get it to go in because it's all stuck together, even though it actually breaks. So there's different kinds of glass we can think about. You may see glass with wire mesh in it. You know, a lot of times you see this in doorways that have little peekaboo windows, those little rectangular windows in classrooms, things like that you can look into. You often see they have what looks like chicken wire, right? If you grew up doing arts and crafts and did paper mache, you'll have fond memories of chicken wire, right? So it looks like chicken wire. And it's basically just a metal web or a metal mesh interwoven into the glass. Again, the idea is if you break the glass may shatter inward, but the wire is going to prevent you from reaching in directly and trying to grab the door handle and, you know, getting in, unless you cut through the wire. And, you know, the point is not to keep you out ultimately, because let's face it, you put your fist through the window and the door, and, you know, you may be able to reach around and grab that. But A, you're going to get you know, all cut up, and B, it's going to take you time to break that, to cut the wire, to do that. And our hope is ultimately during that time, somebody's going to hear something or see something, and you're going to obviously get caught. A lot of these are what we call delaying solutions, right? They're delaying tactics. Having glass in a window in general is, unfortunately, having a window and glass in it is a bad idea, because the reality is if somebody wants to break in, they're going to figure out a way to blow that window out of the frame and crawl through. So the ultimate design solution should be, if I want to give people the ability to look out, I have to understand people may also come in. So how can I delay them long enough and put enough controls in place around that entryway that they may be deterred, and as a result, they may not be able to successfully get into the system. That's really what the goal is with this stuff. It's not to stop you, because we know that if you're really that dead set on getting in, you're going to strap a little bit of explosive to the window, and you're going to blow it out of the frame, and yeah, you're going to make a big noise, and people are going to know you're there, but you're probably still going to go in and do what you want to do, because you're willing to blow a window out of a building. You're probably not going to be stopped by a bunch of people yelling and screaming and going, look, there's somebody there who's coming to attack us, right? So the reality is you're going to get in. We have to figure out ways to prevent you from doing so long enough, delay you, that somebody will hopefully find you, figure that out, and then obviously we can do things we need to do. So we have tempered glass. I talked about this wired glass, laminated glass. You know about bullet-resistant glass probably. They have this in banks, for instance, in data centers called bulletproof glass, but it's actually called bullet-resistant glass. That's the formal name for it. We have glass break sensors. You break the glass, we know you broke it, and yeah, we set off an alarm. We have noise sensors, right? So if you're walking around somewhere late at night, you make a noise, acoustic sensors are what they're called, they may go off. We have infrared sensors, right? Sensors that will detect rise in body temperature and heat. You see these in all the movies. You also may have line break sensors, the infrared lights that are crisscrossing and kind of make the red pattern when they spray the special spray to show you in museums and things like that. When you walk through the system, you break the contact points between the light beams, then the alarm goes off. This is the same principle you have with your garage doors at home. As a matter of fact, you have infrared sensors on the bottom on either side of the garage door. They're safety sensors, right? Because that way, if a child or something is blocking the door stops if you break the line of the sensor as it's coming down, so that way they don't get crushed. It's the same principle. It's just that we use a bunch more of them to protect a whole gateway or a doorway. It's the same idea. So you see a lot of these things everywhere you go. We talked about garages, right, and how important it is to have lighting there to make sure they're safe areas. You don't want to walk into, and I see this a lot, I travel a lot. And I'm in hotels, I'm in airports, I'm in car rental agencies at 2 a.m. at crazy times trying to get to where I need to go. And a lot of times you walk into these garages at the airport and a lot of them have these islands of light, as I call them, and then these pools of darkness, right? So you've got areas that are well lit around the stairway typically, maybe around the landing for the elevator where you come out. But then you look out and there's just like these dark rows that go off into infinity. You can't see what's down there. You don't know who's there. I'm not saying and suggesting for a minute that there necessarily would be somebody there, but you just don't know, and it's scary. I mean, it's scary as an individual, whether you're a man or a woman, to be looking down a long, dark row of cars, wondering if somebody may be hiding there while you're trying to go out and, put your luggage in the back of the car and do what you need to do. This is not a good thing. You go to hotels, a lot of times they're designed incredibly poorly. They have dark parking lots that wrap around the back of the hotel, and there's like one little spotlight, right, in the middle, and then there's like nothing. Right. And so I'm always thinking, well, it's a rental car. So if they break in, I don't care. It's not my car. So I'll park it anywhere. But, the reality is it's unsafe because you make it out of the car. Somebody may be there trying to do you harm. So we have to think about these things when we design buildings. We don't want garages that are dark and scary. We want garages that are well lit. We also want to think about, this is one I often talk about with my customers. In secure environments, secure buildings, you're going to have guards typically inside the building monitoring the perimeter. They actually will also typically walk around the perimeter at night as well, but you're going to have them inside looking at screens typically, looking at cameras. We probably have perimeter lighting. We most likely will have spotlights and things that light up areas of the perimeter, the gate, for instance, the doorways, things like that. What we want to make sure we have is lighting that faces out, right? We want lighting that is away from the building facing out towards the perimeter. So that way the guards, when they're looking at stuff, when they come out of a darkened room into the dark lobby, typically out into the environment, they're not going to be blinded by light shooting in from the perimeter. Because if you spotlight the doorway of the building from 100 feet away and somebody steps out, they're blinded at night. You blow their night vision. They can't see anything. So they're not going to see people coming. They're not really going to be able to be effective as a deterrent. So we want to be thinking about light placement. This is also very important, something we have to consider and be thoughtful of as well. What about fires? When fires happen inside of a building, got to worry about this as well. Fire suppression is very important, right? So we know that we have different kinds of fire suppression equipment based on the kind of fire that we have. Fire is fire in the sense that it all burns. It's all bad. But what causes the fire? What is burning? Is it you lighting a piece of paper on fire versus chemicals burning versus heavy metals that might have caught fire, right? That kind of stuff. Each kind of fire has to be dealt with differently. If it's an electrical fire, you can't spray water on an electrical fire. You could, but you're not going to be very happy with the outcome. Let me put it that way, right? However, if you want a really cool fireworks show,
right?
right? That's the way to go. So we have different classes, class A, class B, class C, and class D. When it comes to different kinds of fires, you probably should know what they are. Class A is ordinary combustible materials. That's paper, wood, things like that. Just stuff you mess around with and you may catch on fire, but you can easily put out with a fire extinguisher, a little bit of water, smother it, you know, whatever that may be. Class B, flammable or combustible liquids. This is gasoline, oil. Think of kitchen fires, right? Where the pan catches on fire because you have oil in it. That's a little bit different. You never throw water on a combustible liquid fire. It spreads the combustible liquid everywhere. It also typically blows up in a huge cloud and will not only spray you, but catch fire at everything around it. So that's never a good idea. We use chemical suppressants there, typically foam and or some sort of chemical suppressant, or cutting off the oxygen by putting a, if it's a small fire, like on a cooktop, you put a
pan or...
Thank you. Charades. Sounds like two words. First word. You put a pan on top of the other pan to cut the oxygen off, and in effect, we smother the fire. But obviously, if it's a big fire somewhere, we have to use things like chemical foam to deal with that. Class C fires, electrical equipment, as I said, no water allowed there. Dry foam or chemical foam of some kind, typically. Maybe some sort of dry extinguisher, but again, nothing with water in and of any kind. Class D, combustible metals. These are really nasty in particular. These can do great harm, and they are very difficult to deal with. You need to leave that to the professionals. The firefighters have to come and take care of that kind of stuff. They have special equipment that they can use to deal with those fires, but it's not something you're going to be equipped to deal with typically. But we should know what the different classes of fire suppression and fire overall are. So I want to just be aware of that and think about that. What about safeguarding server rooms and interconnects for electrical equipment? Again, you know, electrical rooms should be locked. You should have camera surveillance on them. So should server rooms. People should not be able to go in and play with circuit breakers, for instance, right? It's just a bad idea. It's a bad idea because A, they can hurt themselves. Also a bad idea because B, they can cut off power to you in the building. So again, if you're in a common building and there is a common electrical closet or server closet on each floor, you have to make sure that's secured. You have to work with the building management to do that. There may be more than one tenant that has rights and needs access to that. And there may be a bunch of vendors that are coming in to do work for the building and for individual tenants within the building. And again, you have to understand that you may not have exclusive access to these systems. In one of our buildings in down in South Florida, where I'm based, we have one of our centers, right, where I work my day job when I'm not hanging out with you guys doing this. And we have a huge facility. It's about 13,000 square feet. Our electrical room is at the back corner of this particular area of the building. Now, we're not the only tenant, but we are the largest tenant in that particular space. The space directly below us, we happen to be in a mall. So we're upstairs in the office space in a mall. Mall is massive, huge mall. Downstairs, the Department of Transportation for the state of Florida came in and opened up a huge driver's license division there. So they have they took three or four small offices, closed them all, consolidated them, put them into this one space. They built a big data center right below our electrical closet above, right, in the area where we control. They had to negotiate with the building and ultimately with us to come in, have the contractors they use come in and drill conduit connections through our stone slab floor, our concrete floor. It's like, you know, 4 feet thick. Wow. In order to go down through our area to bring their conduit for their fiber runs into their data center below us. And so I had to show up at 2 o'clock in the morning for like 3 days in a row to sit there with them while they're doing all this so they could drill through and make sure it was all working to set it up. And here's the interesting part. They did all this, which is fine. They set up the conduit, all that stuff. It's all good. It's all, you know, right through the floor. Everything's good. They left an interconnect gap of probably, maybe a foot approximately between the conduit and the floor. And they never came back and actually took care of it and enwrapped it or set it up so it's totally secure. So all the fiber is actually running right through that pipe, and there's a gap of about a foot where it meets the floor where you can actually tap right into the fiber if you wanted to. So, you know, the reality is that sometimes, you know, just it was just through dumb circumstance, I'm sure, just they didn't realize and they forgot and just, you know, they never came back. It just never did. It's been that way for years. It's never been a problem. We don't let anybody in there. It's locked up all the time, and, you know, they don't have an issue. And they probably don't even realize it's there. But the point is, it is there, and in theory, we could obviously get into it, or somebody could if they wanted to, right? So, you know, this is the kind of thing you got to think about. These are the kind of things that can obviously happen. So, you know, thinking about not just things like that, but also utilities, right? Power. How do we bring power into the building, as I said? You know, we may use one provider, but in a secure facility, we probably have to use multiple providers bringing in different circuits from different areas. So if one is cut, we still have power coming into the building. We can still, you know, achieve the end results that we need. These are all going to be things that are very important. We have to worry about cable management. Are we, as I said, you know, locking down our cable so nobody can tap in to the fiber, or is it open and exposed? When we run cable, is it in conduit? up in the walls and the ceilings, or is it just run, you know, scattered everywhere and somebody could effectively go up in the ceiling and tap into cables, right? Because we've all had to do that. Oh, I need a cable run. I'm not calling the cable guy. $75 a cable run, right? So yeah, we get up there. Okay, Mike, go down the far end on the ladder. I'm going to throw the cable ball to you. And it just randomly arcs across, right, and winds up. And yep, that's exactly where we wanted it. Right there. The only thing you worry about is not hitting the fluorescent lights, right? To make sure you don't worry about hitting the ballast, and as a result, you have interference. Other than that, you know, if you look up in most ceilings, you're probably going to find a patchwork, literally, of cable connections, and that's the reality. That's just how it looks. So we want to know about that. We obviously want to safeguard these areas. Think about them as well. This is all very important stuff. What about the rack itself? What about the rack of servers? Are we locking the rack? You know, most racks come with locks, and most good IT administrators promptly ignore them, forget where they are, don't worry about the keys, and just don't bother to use them. So the reality is, when I walk into secure data centers, I see cages. That's great. I walk in, I see racks. That's awesome. I walk up to the rack, and the rack is open. And, you know, I'm thinking, well, that's good, but, you know, it's not great. I mean, let's be honest. It's a pain to have to unlock a rack every time you want to go talk to a server and interact with it. But there's a lock on the front for a reason, right? Because people may still climb over the cage and get in, and you may not realize they're there, right? So this is something you have to consider as well. Now, they have manageable rack locks, ones that are automated that could be opened with a card swipe or things like that. It doesn't have to be a key. But the point is, if you don't take the extra step, that's usually where the attacker is willing to go. They're going to go that extra mile, right? They're going to just take it to the limit. If you're not willing to do that, as the Eagles said, take it to the limit one more time, right? If you're not willing to do that, I promise you, at some point an attacker will. And if they're willing to do that and you're not, they win and you lose, right? So that's really what you have to think about. Restricting their ability to get to that information is vital. If you're not able to do that, not willing to do that, that's really an issue. That's something you have to think about. We talked about uninterruptible power supplies, talked about generators, talked about all this stuff, right? It's all important. I talked about HVAC systems and why those are important. Last thing I just want to talk about quickly. Talked about water, talked about fire, right, mixing the two, talked about sprinklers, fire suppression, all that kind of stuff. Want to make sure we know, actually, two things. One, want to make sure we know the different kinds of sprinkler systems. So let's just quickly talk about that. And then I want to say a quick word about fire suppression, but gas-based systems, systems that don't use water, because these are important. We have to know about them as well. So if we have a system that uses water, we have four different ways in which a sprinkler system uses water, in theory, can be set up. It could be a wet system. Could be a dry system, a pre-action system, or a deluge system. Let's just quickly talk about the differences. A wet system is basically water's in the pipes at all time. You know, you go ahead and set off the alarm. The sprinklers basically just immediately drop water everywhere. This is the classic system that we have where in most hotels, most buildings, you see the little colored vial of liquid. If you go up and look at the sprinkler head, you know, red, green, orange, whatever it is, that liquid color indicates the boiling point of the liquid in the glass. So they will boil, the liquid will, at different temperatures. Based on that, there's a certain delay before the sprinkler head actually is active because there's a little piston or a valve that sits behind that little vial. When that vial breaks, it drops, the head opens, in other words, and water is there sitting right behind that, and as a result, water drops out. This is what's called a wet system. So, you know, you often see in the movies, right? Somebody stands up there with the lighter, right? You know, looks like they're at a concert. That's for those of you that are old enough to remember what that means. So they're there, they're doing this, and then all of a sudden, they effectively boil the liquid, the thing bursts, and then all of a sudden the sprinklers come on. But you'll notice they come on everywhere, right? Not just in one place. That's a wet system, water in the pipe everywhere at once. A dry system is essentially the same, but there's no water in the pipe. There's air that is just effectively keeping the pipe open. A water is contained in a holding tank somewhere, and there's a valve further back in the system, probably a series of them, that has to be released before the water actually is going to hit that system. So there's a delay between the time the sprinklers are open and the time that actually water shows up. We're not talking about minutes. This is just, you know, a few seconds, but it's not immediate. There is a small delay. Pre-action systems, water's held back until detectors are going to effectively activate. The nice thing is that this is an area-controlled system. So unlike a wet system, which drenches everything, a pre-action system is going to effectively be targeted based on where the alarm goes off. So if it just goes off in this area right here in front of us, then it's just going to be this one sprinkler, right, that goes off. Nothing else is going to go off, and none of the other systems are going to be activated, which is good because you obviously then minimize damage in other areas of the building because of water showing up and, you know, falling on desks and all sorts of stuff like that. And then a deluge system, all sprinklers in the system are open and all the heads are wide open. This is almost like a rainfall in effect or a waterfall. And when water hits the system, it comes pouring out everywhere. Looks like literally a series of waterfalls that are going to go in and drench the building. These are fast action systems. In a sense, they flood large areas very quickly to put out very, very big fires. That's simply what these kind of systems are used for. And a lot of times, especially in data centers, right, we can't use water because we know water and electricity do not mix. So we're going to use gas-based suppression systems instead. So when you walk into a data center, we may have seen the caution stickers, right? The flammable substance, you know, dangerous gas, whatever. The warning stickers that firefighters often use to, you know, figure out what's in there before they go in and fight a fire. We see them on the front doors of these data centers. So if we say caution gas in use or gas suppression in use, they typically will name the kind of gas. So it may say FM200. It may say Air OK or Argon or CO2 or whatever it is. There's all these different gases. What it probably doesn't say anymore is halon. At least it most likely will not say that anymore. The only time you would have seen a halon system, at least these days, would be if it hasn't already been used and it's sitting there as a relic waiting to be decommissioned and turned over. I've seen these less and less over the last number of years with customers. I have two that actually still use or that have halon systems but have not finally hit the benchmark where they have to retire them, but it's coming up very soon. Halon used to be the gas of choice, but it is no longer used because it is a greenhouse gas, and it causes problems with the ozone. And so when we would fire off these systems, all the halon would eventually get out of the building. So you have to vent the building because halon sucks all the air out of the building. So effectively, it sucks all the air away from the fire, which is very good for fire suppression, not very good for you. If you have to be sitting in the room when this goes off, you will die. So we often have breathing apparatuses that are scattered around the data center for this. There's warning lights that go off, and you certainly usually have a small delay. So you can get out of the area if you need to before the gas goes off. But the idea is that halon is no longer allowed because of a treaty. We actually signed a treaty, the U.S. did, many other countries did, called the Montreal Protocol back in 1987 that bans the use of halon. And as a result of that, it's been effectively banned for use in these systems for, you know, about 30 years now. So most of these systems are reaching the end of their useful life where they cannot no longer, they can no longer be refilled with halon. And so when they go off, they then are going to be switched over to something like Air OK or FM200. So kind of interesting little geek gas information there, if you will. All right, so we're basically going to wrap up our conversation in this area, finish up our discussion about suppression systems, throw it back over to Mr. Mike here, and he's going to take us out.
Fantastic. A lot of great information. Again, physical security, one of those areas that sometimes gets overlooked or some of the finer details, right? We've really got to pay attention to. Great stuff, great insight, Adam. We appreciate that. Remember, if you guys want to attend one of Adam's classes live, shoot us an email, cadam@itpro.tv. That's it for now. Signing off, I'm Mike Roderick.
I'm Montreal Protocol.
And we'll see you next time.
Take care.